This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Normally on Radio EcoShock, my expert guests do the talking while I listen and learn along with you. Later in the program, I'll interview the author of a new book about walk out, walk on. It's a strategy for getting out of an unproductive life, or one damaging to the earth, and finding your own path. I'll also interview Dr. Jochen Hinkel from the Global Climate Forum in Berlin. He's the lead author of a new paper which tries to calculate the economic damage to the world from rising seas. It's a game changer, for sure. But this week, there are major developments I have to tell you about in our story here on Earth. They are not coming through to you clearly or not reported at all. We humans were not made to comprehend the whole globe. Our DNA interprets the forest or the plains right around us. Lately, the Brits must think we are drowning. The Aussies are burning with heat. And Americans feel like the Ice Age has returned. Buried in all that, and in the places major media ignores, is a very serious development. It's simply this. Climate disruption has arrived much sooner than anyone, including the gloomiest scientists or the doomiest doomers, thought was possible. The beast is here now. We must expect a bumpy ride. So-called normal years may return to some places for a year or three, but we're entering a period of severe climate disruption that may extend for the rest of your life and that of your children. The ultimate destination may be a much hotter world where the Arctic Sea is tropical and the skies are placid, but we have a long road before that comes. It is the Great Disruption. Before we consider what that means, I'd like to tie up some reporting from parts of the world that big television networks and newspapers ignore or bury in the back pages. To start with, if anyone tries to sell you on the myth of global cooling, just because of snowstorms on the East Coast or relentless cold in Wisconsin or Winnipeg, the planet is much too hot in other places. I'm not going to cover the big storms hitting the Northeast. Major American media have flooded the world with that stuff, or you lived it personally, so you know.
Australia.
In past weeks, I've told you about Australia. Day after day, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38 degrees Celsius. I think that's what we're all headed for. Nights that don't get much cooler. The resulting bushfires spread, and they became so big they created their own weather systems, complete with dry lightning storms, causing more fires, a positive feedback effect of the worst kind. Australian newspapers admit at least 400 people have died from this recent heat wave, with more to come. Heat is now a leading cause of death in Australia. This could happen in a developed country, and it should come as no surprise. Estimates for the number of people killed in the European heat wave of 2003, from 40,000 to 60,000 dead. There are two lessons here. First, climate change will kill a lot of us directly. And second, yes, the most vulnerable are the kids, the elderly, and people with existing medical conditions. But before that comforts you, remember that sooner or later, that will include you. Before we leave Australia, there's one bit of good news. Despite that country digging in to flood the world with coal, solar power is really picking up in Australia's sunny south. A new report by the Australian Energy Market Operator says the power from rooftop-mounted solar panels saved residents from blackouts that usually accompany a gush of air conditioner use. In 2009, Australia had those blackouts, but just 4 years later, there was enough solar power to shift the peak demand and save the system. It just makes common sense to install solar in a hot, sunny country. Why isn't Arizona listening?
South America.
But let's move on to a heat wave that is hardly reported. I'm talking about the monster heat striking southern Brazil and Argentina during December 2013 and January 2014 and continuing right on into early February. It's a pathetic commentary on the news machine that when I searched Google News for reports on the South American heat wave, most of the reporting was about how it would affect the price of your coffee. It's all about markets for us, isn't it? You have reason to be jittery about the cost of coffee, I suppose. The drought in Brazil has already raised wholesale prices. The other major supplier, Indonesia, has the opposite problem. They are drowning in near-record rain.
A scorching summer in Brazil. The hottest January on record has left reservoirs dry. A high-pressure system has blocked normal afternoon rain during what is typically the year's wettest month.
Brazil's largest city, Sao Paulo, experienced its warmest January on record, with a daily average maximum of 31.9 degrees C or 89.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Normal is about 28 degrees C for that time of year. Then it got hotter in February, around 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees C every single day for the first week. And that's before you figure in the high humidity, which made it all unbearable. In Buenos Aires, it was about 30 degrees C, at least 86 degrees Fahrenheit, every day of December and most days of January. With the humidity, it felt like the mid-40s or 113. In late January, the temperature adjusted for the Humidex reading was 47 degrees or 116. Humans can barely handle that. Only Al Jazeera TV got right down into Buenos Aires, Argentina, to document what it's been like for people there.
Official temperature highs in Buenos Aires have been above 30 degrees centigrade since the beginning of December. But humidity and other factors have made it feel like it's in the mid-40s, and it's likely to stay like that until the new year.
We have been registering meteorological parameters for 141 years. Never in downtown Buenos Aires we had such high minimum persistent temperatures. High temperature, high humidity, and very low atmospheric pressure. It affects the human health. That's why we are alerting the population. Okay, take care.
The heat wave has been putting a major strain on energy supplies, causing power cuts in some neighbourhoods, sometimes for a few hours, occasionally for several days. In the meantime, emergency measures are being implemented and warnings issued about how to deal with the extreme heat. With the constant high temperatures, we're all suffering here, young and old alike. And with no electricity in some cases for 5, 10 or 20 days, the situation becomes unbearable, suffocating. And with no end in sight, we all have to look for respite wherever we can. With some going to any lengths to keep their cool, while all around are fuming about the heat, the humidity and the power cuts. Daniel Schweimler, Al Jazeera, Buenos Aires.
It isn't pretty. Listen to the grandmothers living on the 15th floor after the electricity went out for a couple of weeks during big spikes of demand for air conditioning. Her elevator isn't working, so she must climb all the way up with groceries and water. For me, that's an important lesson for the future. How will you cope with heat when the power goes out? Just a few solar panels and a battery could at least keep the fans running that could save your life.
Overcome by heat. Residents across Buenos Aires are grappling with soaring temperatures of more than 38 degrees Celsius. The heat wave has put severe strain on Argentina's electricity grid. Authorities have issued a red alert and many people living in high-rise buildings are being evacuated.
You cannot live above the 10th floor. Within 48 hours, it's a death trap. If there is sun and it's 38 or 39 degrees, as they're saying, the firefighters are going to bring down bodies.
People have taken to the streets to protest the power cuts, blocking off roads and demanding action from officials. For now, residents have resorted to using candles and bottled water. The hot weather is expected to continue through to next week. Serena Chowdhury, BBC News.
And finally from South America, the well-known fact that overheated humans get grumpy and socially unstable. Just look at the violent riots in Rio de Janeiro over a hike in transit fees.
Well, the rioting so out of control in one city that the main train station had to close down. Take a look at this.
Sure, South America has a reputation for some riots. Who doesn't? But I think we can presume the heat stokes emotions and discontent even higher. If we experience a relatively sudden jolt in temperatures, and in a few minutes I'll explain how that could happen, you should expect some social unrest as a consequence.
Alaska.
Now we'll travel to the least expected, least reported places experiencing record high heat. If the temperature is below zero, can we call it a heat wave? We can if we're talking about the Arctic Circle in winter. You probably heard it was warmer in Homer, Alaska one day in January than it was almost anywhere in the lower 48 states. The same polar vortex that brought snowstorm after storm to central and eastern part of North America kept a big sweep of Hawaiian air running over Alaska. World-known dog sled races were canceled or shoved somewhere else. A series of avalanches, that's melting unstable snow in January, folks, closed down major highways. Places like Nome, Seward, and Homer hit all-time record highs. Kids all over Alaska were out in shorts. Backyard barbecue parties returned, and you can find those videos on the net. That's nutty stuff that could only happen during climate change.
California.
That Alaskan heat was all part of the same weather system that delivered the drought to California, and oh yeah, another series of record high temperatures there. San Francisco is more than 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than a normal January. On the 15th and 16th of January, the temperature rose to 73 degrees, 22 degrees C. Sacramento set more record highs in January 2014 than at any time in its history. Lovely to be in California if you're not a farmer or if you don't eat.
Siberia.
It was the same in January on the other side of the world, and for this I thank Christopher C. Burt, weather historian for the Wonderground blog, posted February 12, 2014, and I quote Burt, "All-time record monthly warm temperatures have been observed at many sites in the Siberian states of Yakutia and Kamchatka. What is normally the coldest permanently inhabited place on Earth, Oymyakon, saw its temperature rise to a February record high of minus 12.5 degrees C or 9.5 degrees Fahrenheit on February 9th, end quote. On February 7th, Oymyakon rose to 2.9 degrees C or 37 degrees Fahrenheit, and that, according to Burt, is the first time this site has ever risen above freezing during the month of February. First time ever. That is mind-blowing. Put that in your mental calendar. Consider what that may mean for extra permafrost melting and even more methane into the Arctic atmosphere if this kind of weather action continues in Siberia. This is the key to whatever nasty weather you have been experiencing. The world has not warmed by that much as a global average, but the poles have warmed way more than anywhere else. When there is a smaller difference between the poles and the equator, there is less to drive the jet stream from west to east. Instead, the jet stream takes huge bends, almost blowing north to south. It gets stuck in those bends. Depending on which side of the stream you are on, your weather gets stuck in a pattern which could be record warmth and drought or record cold and snow. Lucky you, it's all due to climate change, no matter what Rush Limbaugh or any net idiots will tell you.
The United Kingdom.
Before I wrap up with my main point, we can't leave this extreme record report without talking about Great Britain. I've seen satellite pictures that make my jaw drop. One huge single storm just swept over the whole of the islands, burying England, Scotland, and Ireland in a wild pool of gray. Another satellite photos shows a series of giant lakes where the southern English countryside used to be. You can imagine, or if you live there you don't need to imagine, the mental costs to the average person. Day after day of gray wet skies, the worry of floods, the reality of floods, it must affect the economy as well. But right now I'd like to focus on a single aspect of that, and that is the intense storms and high winds and record-setting storm surges that are changing the British coastline forever. I'll have more to say about the coastal damage in Britain in future shows. The British coasts are tumbling into the sea as these storms track into Britain time after time, as they have for the last half dozen years. Winter storms and soggy summers may be the new future of England, all during the long period of climate disruption. Everyone from Dame Julia Slingo, chief scientist for the UK Met Office, to economy whiz Lord Stern, acknowledges Britain's turn towards awful weather is driven by climate change. In another amazing development, the British government has thrown in the towel, admitting that no government can cope with such massive storm damage. They apparently propose to abandon parts of the coast and inland to flooding, and will spend what little money they have protecting major cities like London. That's a song you will hear in many parts of the world. This is Environment Agency Lord Chris Smith on Channel 4 News.
As we've heard, the Environment Agency Chief Lord Smith has said that the country may have to choose between protecting town or country against future floods because it's becoming too costly to defend both. Writing in the Daily Telegraph, Chris Smith questioned how much should be spent saving Lincolnshire, Yorkshire, East Anglia and Somerset.
So there you have it. Our whole landscape could change. river floodplains may expand. Other lakes could disappear due to lack of water. Major cities will go underwater on the coasts. The Canadian-Russian North have already seen major geologic level changes as permafrost melts. All this disruption of the weather and human lives is before. It's before the major change which scientists expect. I know a couple of weeks ago I worried out loud that lower sunspot activity could mask the heat until a new period of high solar storms. I went back and listened to a couple of previous EcoShock interviews to remind myself that the amount of solar activity is not the primary driver of what happens here on Earth. Our emissions are. This week I came across two new scientific studies which show that we may very well be setting ourselves up for not just a gradual increase in global temperatures, but for a series of heat waves that could rock the world. No doubt you've heard some climate scientists have been puzzled why Earth isn't hotter already, considering the physics of the gigatons of greenhouse gases we've stuffed into the atmosphere at an ever-increasing rate. We should be hotter than we are. What caused this so-called hiatus, as dangerous as our current levels are, as we've just seen? From sweltering Australia, the University of New South Wales Climate Research Centre, scientist Matthew England just published a study that explains a lot. It boils down to this. The trade winds blow across the Pacific Ocean from east to west. These winds have been stronger than usual in the past decade. They have roiled the ocean surface, burying more carbon than we expected into the ocean as well as heat. The trade winds rise up now and then, it's just a natural cycle, but then they get quiet. When they do, all that heat energy buried in the upper Pacific waters will rise up, possibly in a period as short as a year or a few years. We'll taste all the warming our emissions really add up to. More people will suffer and die. I'll have a lot to report on. Here is Matthew England, a guest on Radio EcoShock on January 2011, now talking about his new work.
Over the last 12 years, global average surface air temperature has plateaued. And there's a lot of confusion about why this has occurred, because during this same time, greenhouse gases in the atmosphere have shot up to record levels. This pause in the surface warming doesn't mean that global warming has stopped at all. We see Arctic sea ice melting to record low levels. The land ice sheets right around the world are melting rapidly. Ocean temperatures continue to warm. So that it's not a contradiction of global warming, but it has confused scientists because we do expect the surface temperatures around the world to progressively warm decade by decade. Having seen the hiatus in surface warming, a lot of scientists have been trying to understand exactly what's causing it. We know that of all of the energy trapped by greenhouse gases over the last century, already over 90% of that has ended up in the oceans. So all we need is an extra acceleration of ocean heat uptake, and we can get these hiatuses that last for a decade or more. We took all the available measurements of climatic conditions over the last 20 years, and we used those to estimate how much extra heat was going into the ocean. And what we found is that there was more than enough heat going into the ocean to account for that plateauing of global surface temperatures in spite of this increase in greenhouse gases. The reason the oceans are taking up extra heat, and this is particularly occurring in the Pacific Ocean, is that the trade winds have strengthened considerably over the last two decades. In fact, the trend over the last two decades is unprecedented in the measurement record, and it's way beyond the strength of the trends ever captured by climate models. So over the Pacific Ocean, the trade winds blow from the Americas across towards the West Pacific. When they do so, they take all of the surface water westward. So a lot of the warm surface water ends up north of Australia in a big pool of water we call the West Pacific Warm Pool. Now, if the trade winds blow particularly strong, that warm water that's piled up there starts to converge into the ocean interior. There are overturning cells, basically taking warm surface water and pumping them into the interior of the ocean. And in a way, it's locking away energy that we've obtained from greenhouse gas into the subsurface ocean. And that's what causes this hiatus. So if the trade winds slow down or stop, what happens is that heat absorption by the ocean reverses, and we actually get heat coming back up into the atmosphere. And the bad news is that out of this hiatus, we're expecting quite rapid warming to occur.
Professor England's study has been tested against climate models, and indeed, just the trade winds could account for the missing heat. When those winds go quiet, you better have your living situation ready if you can. It's going to get even wilder. Finally, the tipping point for me this week was a fairly quiet release of another scientific paper from Germany. Armin Bunde and the colleagues of Justus Liebig University, along with some lead Chinese authors, predict that 2014 could be a record hot year again. How do they know? It comes down to whether we will have an El Nino or not. the eastern Pacific Ocean has an oscillation between the cooler La Niña, which we had for the past few years, and the heat-generating El Niño, which brought the last record-setting heat monster of 1997-98. Until very recently, no one could predict when an El Niño would come. It's an important thing to know. By studying weather and ocean patterns, the German and Chinese researchers realized it all hinges on the connection of two regions in the eastern Pacific. If these connections are made and the atmosphere behaves in a certain way, there is a 75% chance El Niño will come. The scientists say we crossed that threshold in September 2013. That gives us a 75% chance, pretty high in scientific terms, that 2014 will see an El Niño. The paper is titled Increasing Frequency of Extreme El Niño Events Due to Greenhouse Warming. It was published in the journal Nature Climate Change in January 2014. I've put a link in my blog where you can read that El Niño article in full for free. That's at ecoshock.info. In fact, you'll find links to all the science and news I've talked about today, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. If the trade winds go quiet in the same year as an El Niño, Earth and all its inhabitants, of all kinds, could experience a jolt of heat from our past emissions. We don't know what the trade winds will do this year. There's a 25% chance El Niño won't come. But sooner or later, these and other boogies like melting methane clathrates and a whole series of positive feedback loops could bring on the big climate jump, decades before those predictions were made just a few years ago by the IPCC scientists. Hang on to your hats for that. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Some get strong, some get strange. Sooner or later, it all gets real. Walk on, walk on, walk on, walk on.
Maybe you see our way of living is in big trouble. The economy is starting to self-destruct, and maybe the whole world ecosystem with it. You don't want to be part of that, but what can you do? Maybe you should walk out and walk on. That's the title of a book and a movement co-authored by Margaret Wheatley and Deborah Fries. I've got Deborah on the line now. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be here.
Well, Deborah, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed permaculture co-founder David Holmgren. He suggests large numbers of people should leave a deadly economy to create the world that they do want. Isn't that just what you did in 2001? Tell us about that.
So I was actually part of the dot-com world. I had been an internet entrepreneur and from 98 to 2001, which was the peak of that experience. And I got extremely disillusioned toward the end, not just the way the bubble burst, but mostly about the way people behaved inside of the system. And I worked with several people who I thought were behaving in greedy ways, very short-term focused. And my first reaction was, these are bad people. And I had, fortunately, some wonderful mentors who sat with me in that thought. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized they weren't bad people. They were playing a flawed game, that the way that we had designed the system of business, or really the game of business, was generating behavior in the system that made people look bad and made them look like their motivations were greedy. And so that actually introduced me to systems thinking, which somewhere along the way I never got introduced to in my conventional education, which led me to Peter Block and led me to Meg Wheatley, and that was about questioning what are the conditions and the designs of the systems that we're living in that generate outcomes and behaviors that we don't want.
So before a person gets to walk on, though, they do have to walk out, as you did. What does that mean for people in the real world?
Well, in my case, it did mean walking out of my job and walking out of a whole field, walking out of business. It can mean that. More often, it means walking out of a set of beliefs that you don't know that you're holding. They've been inherited by the culture that we're in, and a set of beliefs like maximize efficiency at all costs or maximize profit or consume as much as you can. These are sets of beliefs that are in our dominant culture that most of us didn't actually consciously choose. We inherited them. And when they're tied into a system or an institution, then they're embedded in us as well. And so walking out is actually distinguishing the belief, consume as much as you can, maximize profit, and saying, I actually don't want to live in a world where that becomes my belief. So I can actually walk out of the belief and experiment with that without necessarily having to walk out of the institution, though I may find myself at some point in conflict with the institution.
So does this ability to walk out, is it limited to educated and relatively well-off people in developed countries?
No. In fact, the name of the movement came from India, and the story is that there were a number of young people in Udaipur, India. This is a story that came from my friend Manish Jain that we wrote about in the book. Manish was living in Udaipur, and he noticed there were many high school dropouts in his community, and he started to talk to them about their lives. And, you know, the story was that they had dropped out of high school because they'd failed at school. And the more he looked at their lives, he found that what they were doing is they were apprenticing with people, different like craftspeople in the community. They were talking with elders. They were sitting with each other and exploring ideas and creating true learning for themselves. And he said, you know, you're not dropouts. That's what the system says. You're walkouts. You didn't fail the system. The system failed you. Congratulations on walking out of it and creating learning in the world and in your community because the school failed to create learning for you in these kinds of factory schools that are very testing-oriented that are trying to produce productive workers. So it can happen anywhere, in any culture, in any level of poverty or richness.
We're not used to the idea of emergence that you talk about in our Western-style civilization. Just tell us briefly, what is it and how does it apply to these kind of life choices?
So the conventional way that we think about change actually has a real industrial mindset or machine mind, that we look at change like we can plan for it, that it is controllable, causal, predictable, and linear. So we do our five-year plans, right? Here we are today. We look out 5 years. We say this is where we want to be, and we create a roadmap to get there. And inevitably, we never arrive at the destination we set because life is complex, emergent, and unpredictable. That means that we don't actually behave like machines. It isn't a planable, predictable phenomenon of change. Change happens in life through emergence, which is the idea that local action gets connected, and as those connections get stronger and stronger, suddenly and surprisingly, a new system of higher order emerges. And an easy way to think about this is like a beehive or ant. So you have very small local action happening at the level of the individual ant or bee, but the order that exists at the hive is of a whole different nature than the intelligence in the individual. And so emergence is the phenomenon of small local actions connecting to reveal higher order.
That's fascinating. And another stimulating idea I found in your writing was the idea that a system can reach a stage of impotence, as you call it. Are we there now?
So this might be debatable, but some people, you know, would say whether nobody planned for our education system, our healthcare system, our government system, Wall Street, to be as futile in many ways as they are today. That is an emergent phenomenon. And so as systems mature, self-organization gets replaced by over-organization, and compliance becomes more important than creativity. So we start to reverse the means and the ends, and we struggle to uphold the system rather than having the system support us. And when systems reach this stage of impotence, then we as individuals and communities have a choice. We can either keep trying to change a complex emergent phenomenon, which is incredibly difficult, or we can abandon it. And that's what walking out is about. The suggestion that these complex systems are very, very difficult to repair. And instead of repairing them, we can turn our back on them and work on creating something new.
Yes, Joseph Tainter talked about complex systems. And, you know, it almost reminds me of the times of the Romans when that empire was falling apart. And maybe the Christian movement came along as a kind of hospice for it. And you talk about hospice. How does that apply to the troubled world around us?
So we talk about, you know, when we want to look at giving rise to new systems, the experimentation in the new, the pioneering role, is very challenging. There's lots of failure. We don't know what we're doing. And so there's still dominant systems that we need to continue. And we call it hospice work, when people are working inside of a dying system. So let's say something like the oil economy or industrial food, right? So you have a failing system, and yet the new one, renewable energy or local organic food, those systems are not ready to sustain all of us in the world. We actually need people to stay inside the dominant system as it's dying, in the role of hospice workers, giving comfort and support and decreasing the suffering that the failure of those systems are causing. So the role of the hospice worker is critical. Sometimes people get the idea that the pioneer developing the new is very glamorous. You can have the pioneering ideas, and you can be in that role of shedding limiting beliefs and stay inside of dominant systems in order to provide this compassionate care.
Well, on a personal level, though, Deborah, isn't it going to feel lonely if we are pioneers when we disconnect from the social pathways that we've taken for granted all our lives?
I think it can feel very lonely if we do that in isolation. And the one thing that we've learned the most from all of the different pioneers that we've talked to around the world is pioneering leaders feel isolated and alone. They desperately need each other. The minute they look for each other, they find each other. This process for me has been one of the least lonely journeys I've ever taken, but it requires finding fellow pioneers. And what seems to be remarkable to me is actually how easy it is to find them, whether it's in our local communities or somewhere else because of our issue area. They're all over the place. And it's just about creating the conversation and the invitation to find out who else is thinking like me, who else is raising the kinds of questions that I am, even inside of my institutional life. Is it possible for me to find fellow pioneers who are thinking differently about life and about change?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest, Deborah Fries. We're talking about walking out of dead-end lifestyles. And I have to say, though, that the systems we're trying to change, it has lots of defenses. It has a history of jailing people, of spying people, and trying to crush alternative pioneers. How do we deal with that?
This has been a challenging question for us all along, and there's some sort of conversation about working under the radar versus when we pop up above the radar. And that's actually starting to happen in the world today about some of these pioneering lifestyles around renewable energy and alternative food and things like that, where when we don't know what we're doing, which is the early stage of pioneering, we do work under the radar. We talk among each other. We experiment together. When we get strong enough and connect to enough of others like us, then it's possible to face the dominant system. So we actually can only do that in crowds, in connectivity. And so that's the part where emergence becomes significant, because the notion that these, again, the small local action is easily crushed or co-opted by the dominant system. But small local action that's connecting to other small local action, to other small local action, becomes a resilient system that can withstand attack.
You've talked about this idea of two loops theory of change, and I believe you gave the example of peak oil in one of your talks. How does that work?
The two-loop theory of change is what I've been talking about, with this notion that there's a dominant system, and every system has a life cycle. That's how you think about living systems. And it rises, and it peaks, and it moves into decline. And sometime around the peak, alternatives to the dominant system show up. So the example that we talk about often is in the 1970s, when the United States hit its peak oil, we saw the rise of a lot of alternative energy, solar, geothermal, wind, et cetera. And we also saw the kind of shocks in supply and demand during the oil crises that indicated we were at some sort of peak. That's a sign of peak. When the new alternatives showed up, it started to work for a while, right? We had tax incentives. Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the White House roof. The system, the new alternative renewable energy system is starting to arise, but every system is inclined towards self-preservation. And so Reagan comes into office, the tax incentives go underground, and he takes the solar panels off the White House roof. Because the system, the dominant system of an oil economy, is trying to preserve itself and crush the alternatives. The good news is, when a system is really peaked and really is dying, the alternatives will continue to show up and continue to show up. And here we are several decades later with a truly viable renewable economy emerging in a place like Iceland that is 100% renewable. So this notion is that as the two loops, as the top loop is the rise and peak and decline of a dominant system, and another loop giving birth underneath it, that in the time between the peak of the dying and the emergence of the new, which I think is a time we're living in across many systems today, we see a lot of turbulence alongside an enormous amount of innovation.
Well, maybe we're ready to walk out, but then the obvious question is, what are we supposed to walk on to? Give us some suggestions there.
This suggestion is very, very messy. We talk about walking out and walking on, and in between the two is a stage that we call the trembling. And the trembling is, I've figured out the limiting beliefs that I no longer want to live under, and I don't know yet what I'm ready to walk on to. And I have to hang out in this state of unknowing and uncertainty. And the reason is that if I walk on right away, I'm likely to walk right back in. I'm likely to still hold beliefs from the dominant system that I'm not aware of that direct me, pull me back into an old model. And so hanging out in the trembling is this place of discomfort. It requires a lot of internal space, so some silence, some quiet. It requires community. And the motto that I use for hanging out in that space is something I learned from one of Meg's colleagues, Myron Kellner Rogers, who said, start anywhere, follow it everywhere. That means I don't have to know where I'm going. I could hang out in the trembling and say, there's something that I want to explore around the role of money. There's something I want to explore about my relationship to waste. And the first thing is right in front of me. I'm going to start to upcycle all my garbage, whatever it might be. I'm going to do one small experiment, and then I'm going to see what that leads to. And then I'm going to see what that leads to. And that's the way out. If we think too big right away, it's frightening. We don't know how to do it. So it's these small actions, this start anywhere, follow it everywhere, to get from the trembling to what I want to walk on to.
Now, for some people, these ideas lead to the idea of intentional communities. Have you visited some of those? Could you talk to us about a couple?
Yeah, I mean, the one I'd like to talk about the most is Kafunda Learning Village in Zimbabwe, and that is also what we wrote about in our book. Kafunda is an amazing place that was started by a woman named Marianne Canute, who had left Zimbabwe and gotten involved in international networks and had quite a career, and said, I need to go back home, and I need to create community where I've come from, in a country who essentially went through a total systems collapse on every level. And in the face of no money system, no school system, no health care, a failed food system, a small group of people gathered together and said, in the face of actual scarcity, what would happen if we declared abundance? What would happen if we were bold enough to say we have what we need? What would we be able to create together? So it was an experiment just like, how can we go live in an intentional community because it feels nice? We don't have a choice. And from that place, Kafunda has created one of the most astonishing places I've ever been in my life, that I've learned from more than anywhere about what it means to live in community and to create and be resourceful and be inventive in the face of constraints.
Well, there's a large number of people in North America and in England and in Australia who think that this could happen even to our own societies, where money becomes relatively worthless fairly quickly, and we have a supreme economic destructive period. So, you know, and we have the preppers are getting ready for that. How can we plant these seeds of what you're talking about so that they're out there if such a time arrives?
I think that this is where I think it's all about local relationship. So we really have to look at the places that we live in and what our preparedness is for disturbance and shock. So when we live with the intentional relationship to being a resilient community, a community that can respond to disruption, the way that we do that is by being in deep personal relationship with our neighbors, even more so than what are the institutions that are here. It means that I know who lives around me. I'm experimenting with them. We're learning what it takes to grow food. I live in downtown Boston, so we're learning what it takes to grow food together. We're experimenting with alternative economies. We have some way of being in relationship with each other. So, you know, I'm part of a transition town network, which I think is one of the useful tools for it. There are many other tools like that, but we need to figure out how we can restore our relationship as citizens and neighbors and community. It's the only way. Again, it's that same notion of emergence. If we're in relationship with each other, we have the ingenuity and the intelligence and the trust that we need to face disruption.
Well, Deborah Fries, another reason I called you up is about the future of climate change and extreme weather events, which we're already experiencing. It looks like millions, maybe billions of people could find themselves in an environment that's no longer livable. They may have coastal cities that flood over, or maybe persistent long-term drought that kills off agriculture. How do you see the future for walk out, walk on in those kind of scenarios?
I think this is where my experience in Zimbabwe was so powerful for me, because that's what it looks like, right? That is an example of a very rapid total system failure in a community. And the response was diving in with our hands. This was not about getting outsiders and government agencies and nonprofits to respond. This was a community that was ignored. In fact, one of the things we talk about in Walk Out, Walk On, the theme is, in these communities, no one is coming to help. Now what? And the now what is, how do we grow food together? How do we exchange goods and services? How do we take care of our elders? How do we take care of our children? And it comes back to what sounds like overly simple, but being in relationship side by side and starting now to practice. I mean, I live in a wonderful community that has, you know, everybody I know is growing food in their backyard as much as they can and on their rooftops and using bicycles and figuring out, how do we experiment with this moving past peak oil? How do we experiment with the kind of climate crisis that we're in and learn how to adapt? We need to learn how to adapt and be rapid learners. And that comes back to neighbors practicing together.
And in your blog entry, I found this quote from the poet William Stafford: "It's time for all the heroes to go home." What are you talking about there?
So we have a model of heroic leadership in our country and in the world that imagines that our leaders are going to save the day, right? We expected Obama to come in and save the day. We expect any of our leaders, our CEOs, heads of Wall Street, things like that they're going to fix our problems. And obviously the answer is the opposite. And the reason is, no single leader today can possibly know the answers. Our problems are complex, emergent phenomenon. The only way out of that is through collective intelligence. It's the leader, not as hero, who we're supposed to follow, but the leader as host, who convenes many people to bring forward their gift and their perspective. So we take the intelligence on the margins instead of the center, and we bring all of our gifts to solving the problem collectively. And so that's the shift from hero to host, is saying, and we're colluding in it. We collude in our dependence on our leaders. It's time for our leaders to invite all of us to show up, and it's time for us to be willing to take responsibility for solving our problems.
Boy, I can hear a lot of that in stressed communities all over, where the mayor calls the meeting and we're supposed to sit and listen to experts and then all go away without saying anything. It just doesn't work out that way. Look, we're not going to get too far talking about Walk Out and Walk On without talking about Margaret Wheatley. Tell us about her, please.
I met Meg back in 2002, and it completely changed my life. She had written a book in 1991 called Leadership in the New Science, and it was a breakthrough in thinking about how living systems is the way that we can look at the world instead of this industrial or machine mindset that I talked about earlier. The notion that the way we've modeled human organization is on machine, like people do what they're told and should be controlled. And living systems says humans are fundamentally creative and inventive. Why don't we design organizational life that works with the dynamics of emergence and self-organization? That's how life changes. That's how human organization should be designed. And from that, she created the Berkana Institute, where I succeeded her, which was about looking at this question of, if we look at life and change through this living systems lens, how then will we design our organizations? What do we expect of leaders? And how do we want to behave in community? And so conversation becomes the center of it, dependence on collective intelligence rather than the expert or the heroic leader, and this notion that we can't predict where we're headed, but through relationship we can create the conditions for the systems that we wish to arise.
So I have to ask, though, is this movement different from the counterculture of the late 1960s when Timothy Leary advised us to turn on, tune in, and drop out?
I certainly hope so. I don't think it has anything to do with dropping out. It's the opposite. It's full engagement. It's stepping forward with my intelligence, with my gifts, and with my perspective in every environment I walk into. That means both at home with my neighbors, it means in the workplace, and it means in civic engagement. What it's shifting from, it's we're not trying to fight the power that be, and if we don't want to fight, then we drop out. It's actually using what I think of, instead of fighting and dropping out, I think of it as using seduction and charm, saying there is another way to work with change, and there's another world that we wish to give birth to, and it is so engaging and it is so exciting. So an example of that is we work with the dynamic of play rather than power. So a lot of the change approach in the 60s around change was fighting power, working against power, demonstrating against power. And the way that we look at it is playing to change the world because it's more fun, it's more compelling, and by the way, it's also incredibly subversive. So there's other ways to be fully engaged without the struggle and without the suffering and without dropping out.
Can you give us some websites with more information or tell us what resources you offer and talk about the book a little too, please?
Sure. So Walk Out, Walk On is the book chronicles seven different communities around the world that we believe have walked out and walked on to build healthy and resilient communities and what the patterns and practices of those communities are and how they apply to us. And then we've got walkoutwalkon.net. And on that website, we list many, many different resources, videos, books, articles in each of the different areas that we've looked at, both in terms of sector, like education and food, as well as place, the seven different places that we visit. So that lists quite a few resources. And there's also the Burkana Institute, which is burkana.org.
And you have your own website, don't you?
And I've got three other websites. Yes, I've got DeborahFreeze.com and then the two initiatives that I'm involved with today. One is called the Old Oak Dojo, which is a learning center that I've built, modeled on the communities I visited that is right here in Jamaica Plain in Boston, and the Boston Impact Initiative, which is BostonImpact.com, which is about restructuring the way we use money and investment to support local economies.
I found this really inspiring. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about getting out and helping a dying system head towards a life that you can really believe in. Our guest is Deborah Freeze, co-author of the book Walk Out, Walk On. Thank you for all your work, Deborah. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Alex.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As great storms pound the British coast, after other massive storms washed over the Philippines and even New York City, we can only wonder what the costs and damage from seaborne flooding will be as this century goes on. A new paper published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences tries to calculate just that. The paper is titled Coastal Flood Damage and Adaptation Costs Under 21st Century Sea Level Rise. This global projection was created by a team of scientists from Germany, several from British universities and the Tyndall Center, with more from Belgium, the Netherlands, and Austria. From the Berlin offices of the Global Climate Forum, I'm pleased to welcome the lead author of that paper, Dr. Jochen Hinkel. Hello, Dr. Hinkel.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Fine, thank you, and I'm glad you could join us. So in a nutshell, what was the purpose of organizing this study and the resulting paper?
Frankly, there was no global assessment of the total damages of increased storm surge flooding that sea level rise and climate change could cause.
Okay, well, reading the paper through, a great number of questions and difficulties arose in my mind. Why don't we start with the critical problem of estimating sea level rise? The paper suggests a big range of possibilities by the year 2100, from 23 centimeters, say 10 inches, all the way to 123 centimeters, or 4 feet. Why such a big difference in projections?
The main uncertainty in this projection comes from the ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica. We don't have sufficient knowledge to say how fast these will melt. We know they are melting, and this melting has accelerated over the last years, but we don't know how this acceleration is going to go on. So research has just started to build physical models in order to explore ice sheet dynamics in more detail.
And we know the sea is not really level. For various reasons, water tends to pile up in some regions and not others. Did your study take this into account?
Yes, it did. I mean, indeed, there is sort of a dynamic effect due to ocean circulation that we have higher sea levels at one point of the world than in others. But these regional patterns, they may vary up to, 40, 50 centimeters of global mean sea level rise. However, they are much smaller than the total global mean sea level rise that is expected.
So will major cities, some of them experience more sea flood damage than others?
Well, I mean, it is known that, for example, on the east coast of the U.S., it is expected that sea levels rise faster due to those dynamic effects. Yeah, for that east coast, I think the difference is around 20 centimeters to the global mean by the end of this century.
What about the role of extreme storms like those hitting Britain this winter? Is storm surge included in this research, and how does that relate to what you've been studying?
Yes, I mean, we focus exclusively on damages done by storm surges. However, we do not model storm surges themselves. We just assume that we have the current storm surge regime, and this is sort of transferred upwards with rising sea levels. So meaning that if you have a 100-year storm and you have a global mean sea level rise of 1 meter, then this storm will be 1 meter higher after sea level has risen. This is sort of a standard assumption that pretty much works up till now, I mean, based on the observed evidence.
And Dr. Hinkle, you also find that humans are encroaching on the sea more and more, especially in cities. That's another factor, not really climate change. It's our activities. Tell us about that.
Yes, I mean, this factor is actually as relevant as sea level rise itself. So, I mean, well, there are basically two things going on. On the one hand, people are moving towards the sea because the sea is attractive. People like to live at the sea, well, for recreational reasons or also for tourism, tourist industry, etc. And on the other hand, we have sort of overall growth in population, in particular in Asian and African countries. So just by taking the current trends in population, we expect that cities in coastal regions in Africa and Asia will grow dramatically during the century.
So what are the estimates for populations exposed to sea level flooding by 2100?
Well, this depends on the population scenario that you assume. What we have done, and which is also pretty standard, is that you take a couple of scenarios. Those are based on sort of overall assumptions about global development. And then you estimate what that means in terms of population numbers and in terms of GDP. And so what we have here under the scenarios, we assume global population will be between 7 and 14 billion in 2100. And if we estimate how many people will live below the 100-year flood, this will be between 90 and 310 million.
When we take into account the population trends you've spoken about and the current emission of paths, you worked out what percentage of the world population would be flooded annually by the end of this century. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yes. So this assumes that people don't adapt. So basically, if we don't do anything, if we just let sea level rise happen and don't change the way we live or build dikes or move away from the coast, then we estimate that around 600 million people will experience annual flooding in 2100.
And so what is it going to cost? What are the projected damages to the world's domestic product from this flooding alone?
So if we again assume no adaptation, then we estimate damages up to $100 trillion per year in 2100. So this is the upper estimate, taking the highest population scenario, taking the highest sea level rise scenario.
And you've talked about adaptation. What can we do?
Well, I mean, there's a lot we can do, because sort of the other message of our paper is that if we adapt, the damages can be reduced dramatically. So if we upgrade dikes, for example, this is the scenario we analyzed, then the damages will only, well, in parentheses, will only be around 80 billion per year, which is more or less in the same order of magnitude as it is today. So today we are around 20, 30, 40 billion US dollar per year damages done by storm surges.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with scientist Jochen Hinkle. He's the lead author of a new paper called Coastal Flood Damage and Adaptation Costs Under 21st Century Sea Level Rise. I'm going to assume that Asia and Africa don't match the capacity of the developed world to make these adaptations. I mean, how could they spend $10 billion on adapting new regimes for flooding?
I mean, first of all, and we're talking on the long time scale, and also people in Asia and people in Africa are going to get richer. But clearly now those countries cannot afford that. And so they would need international support in meeting the demand for increased flood protection.
Now, I was astounded to read in a recent study that was brought up by one of our guests, Professor J. Court Stevenson from the University of Maryland, that American scientists predict we will have flooding similar to Hurricane Sandy every year by about 2050, 2060. What could New York and Washington do to survive that?
Well, I mean, certainly there are many options. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, if you think about Long Island and sort of the exposed barrier islands or so, I mean, people could simply move away or retreat. I mean, of course, it's nice to live there, but it's also quite difficult to protect those. On the other hand, I mean, certainly Manhattan itself, it just cannot, we're never going to see the big cities move away from the coast. So there we need to build sea walls, we need to build barriers and groins and dikes, etc. So there are many options. And sort of what mix of options is best suited, that's really a question that requires detailed analysis for the particular case you're looking at.
Well, so far we've seen no successful agency able to mount an international response to climate change, really. Dr. Hinkle, who would be able to act on the warnings and recommendations in your study?
I mean, actually, I'm not that pessimistic in the sense that adaptation to sea level rise in terms of building dikes, it is something very common nowadays. And also, I mean, if you think about many cities of the world, they have experienced sea level rises of several meters during the 20th century, not due to climate change, but due to subsidence, human-induced subsidence, due to sediment compaction as a result of withdrawing ground fluids from the ground. They have subsided by several meters. So examples are Tokyo, Bangkok, Shanghai, etc. And they have managed to adapt by building dikes. Also, if you look at the UK, Netherlands, and Germany, I mean, there are many people living below the height of sea level protected by dikes. So, I mean, it's clear that this works, and it's also clear that this is going to happen if damages increase dramatically.
In addition to doing new science, the Global Climate Forum, of which you are part, aims to help organize different stakeholders to develop rational responses. What sort of follow-up will be done on the results of this study?
Well, we are looking at many cities in detail now. So, I mean, the question I raised before about the specific responses a particular location may take, that's sort of the next question we are addressing, and we are having a case study in Shanghai, for example, looking into those responses.
And I noticed that your department at GCF also includes something called social learning. How does that apply to this problem of a human population growing rapidly in areas dangerously overexposed to sea flooding?
Well, maybe a remark on sort of the mission of the GCF in general that you mentioned before. So, I mean, we believe that we need a dialogue amongst all the people involved in the problem in order to address those radical problems. I mean, the debate on climate change, it has been very much heated by sort of strong advocacy on the one hand and climate skepticism on the other hand. And I mean, this is not really a rational exchange of arguments amongst sort of grown-up people. I think it's very important to be analytic, to be open to debate and to different opinions, and this is what we're trying to do. So bringing that to the coastal situation, I mean, if you want to adapt to sea level rise, it's very important bringing all the people with the diverse interests together at one table and trying to figure out sort of win-win solutions, possibilities that offer sort of for everybody involved a viable future. If we don't do that, then this is never going to happen.
Our guest on Radio EcoShock has been Dr. Jochen Hinkel. He's with the Global Climate Forum, headquartered in Berlin. Dr. Hinkel is the lead author of a new PNAS study titled Coastal Flood Damage and Adaptation Costs Under 21st Century Sea Level Rise. You can find links to all you need to follow up on this story in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you very much for helping us out, Dr. Hinkel.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex. Please support this program at our website, ecoshock.org, and download all our past programs as free MP3s while you're there. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock.